A quick word from our sponsor, Freed. If you're looking to streamline your workflow, Freed is an AI scribe designed to help you do just that. Freed will listen, transcribe, and draft your note, all the while being fully HIPAA compliant. I've been using Freed regularly on my shifts, and I do have to say it is really user-friendly. It seamlessly integrates into my workflow on the phone and on the computer. I've also really appreciated how it really adapts to my style of note writing. I think we all have our unique ways we like our notes to be. For what it's worth, I think it can be a huge game changer in making all our days feel a bit more manageable. And you can also use the code CORE50 to get $50 off your first month of Freed. Again, that's CORE50 for $50 off your first month of Freed. So give it a try and see how an AI scribe can make a difference in your day. And with that, let's get into the episode. Welcome to the Core AM Thigh Pearls podcast. This is Dr. Shreya Trivedi.
Hello, I'm Dr. Nate Long, a senior resident at BIDMC.
Let's get started with the pearls we'll be covering today. Be sure to test yourself by pausing after each of the five questions. Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl number one, clinical presentation of monoclonal gammopathies.
How common are monoclonal gammopathies and what are the typical illness groups?
Pearl number two, initial workup.
What are the initial tests to send off, and particularly, what's the difference between an SPEP, immunofixation, and free light chain assays?
Pearl number three, urine testing.
When is urine testing necessary and when is it not?
Pearl number four, spectrum of monoclonal gammopathies.
How do you counsel patients based on if they have MGUS, smoldering myeloma, or multiple myeloma?
Pearl number five, monoclonal gammopathy of clinical significance, aka MGCS.
What is monoclonal gammopathy of clinical significance, and what are the different ways it presents? All right, Nate, let's get started with what actually is a monoclonal gammopathy? That term gets thrown around, but what actually is it?
Yeah, so I sat down with Dr. Aaron Goodman, who's a hematology oncologist at UC San Diego, also known as Papa Heme on X, and he broke it down in an easy-to-understand way, really without giving us too much anxiety about everything we forgot around immunology.
The plasma cell is our professional antibody-producing cells, okay? And each plasma cell makes one specific type of antibody, but we got a gazillion plasma cells, so we make a gazillion different types of antibodies, and it helps us fight infections. So what is a monoclonal gammopathy? Just like you can get clones of cells in your skin like moles, you can also get clones of cells in your colon called polyps. You can get clones of your plasma cells, okay? And as we age, mutations are happening really in all of our cells. We kind of are selecting for plasma cells that are small clones of each other that are more fit. Now, these small clones, they still do what the normal plasma cell does. They secrete antibody, but now they're secreting one type of antibody, okay? A little bit more than they should. And that's called a monoclonal gammopathy. So a monoclonal gammopathy really is a small clone of plasma cells or a large clone, depending on what we're talking about, that secretes one type of antibody that we can detect on testing. And this condition can be anywhere from benign thing that we see with aging, MGUS, to an overt hematologic malignancy called plasma cell myeloma.
Yeah, so there's a whole spectrum of what the clonal population of plasma cells can mean, anywhere from MGUS to myeloma. And we're going to demystify all of that throughout this episode.
Yes, so much to unpack here. I think one thing I didn't appreciate was just how prevalent plasma cell disorders can be.
Plasma cell disorders are quite common. So about 5% of the general population in the United States above the age of 50 will have a monoclonal protein. And the monoclonal protein is simply the antibodies made by a single clone of cells, and they're all of the same type. So they really stick out like a church spire on an electrophoresis gel. So since it's so common, anytime you order an SPEP, you have a 1 in 20 chance somebody's going to have a monoclonal protein.
And now that I think about it,
plasma cell disorders being common really does fit with my clinical experience, right? I think I've sent off so many SPEPs for heart failure workup as a reflex, which is debatable, and have gotten back kappa lambda ratios that were abnormal that I didn't know what to do with. And yes, almost all these patients did not have cardiac amyloid.
So one really firstly needs to be very clear, why are we doing this test? Because otherwise you are going to get a test that's positive and you have to deal with why is this test positive. So I usually say order the test when you're suspecting multiple myeloma or related plasma cell disorder like amyloidosis or Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, and not to do the test when you just test part of a routine workup, because you will be faced with a positive test that you're not sure how quite to interpret.
That is really going to be a theme of the episode, which is to choose wisely about when and who to test.
Yes, I'm so excited to get to that testing later. I learned so much from that. But before we do, let's understand what are the clinical pictures that should get our spidey senses up to send these tests out for.
So I appreciated hearing what these common illness scripts are from Dr. Vincent Rajkumar. Illness scripts that should really trigger us to test for these disorders. And it may feel like a whole list of random things, but to ground us, let's build off the CRAB mnemonic, a mnemonic I think most of us have heard of.
Yeah, it stands for hypercalcemia, renal dysfunction, anemia, and bone lesions. And don't worry, if it feels like a lot, we will recap all of this.
Okay, first up, let's do the first and last letter, the C and the B, hypercalcemia and bone lesions, since they usually go hand in hand.
Anybody with hypercalcemia is suspect, particularly if they have the lytic bone lesions. Usually, you don't have high calcium without bone lesions. So anybody with lytic bone lesions, I'm thinking myeloma unless proven otherwise, and I'm getting that done. And if it's negative, then I'll do a bone marrow. And if that's also negative, then I'm biopsying one of the lesions.
And then onto the R of the CRAB mnemonic, R for renal failure.
Renal failure, unexplained renal failure, particularly if the calcium is high, because calcium is usually low in renal failure. And if the calcium is high, I'm always thinking that constellation makes me worried about myeloma. Worried about myeloma where the renal failure is accompanied by granular casts or a high urine protein. The dipstick won't measure it, but you know, a lot of granular casts means there's proteinuria, or you had a 24-hour urine protein, then I am worried that it could be myeloma. And again, you will look at the result and then decide. If it's renal failure caused by CAS nephropathy, the light chain level should not be borderline. It should not be like, you know, 29 milligrams per deciliter per liter or 50 milligrams per liter. It should be 500 milligrams per liter or 1,500 milligrams per liter or something. So it's, you look at the magnitude of the abnormality, whether it correlates.
So think about a plasma cell disorder if there's renal failure and hypercalcemia, because usually we see normal to low calcium in our run-of-the-mill standard chronic kidney disease, or if there's significant CAS nephropathy from all of those free light chains being filtered through and plugging up the kidney tubules. And again, I think we should take all of this with a grain of salt, because many presentations are possible.
Yes. It does feel a little overwhelming to think about all the different presentations, but do appreciate that we can ground ourselves with a common CRAB mnemonic. Let's move on to the A of CRAB, anemia. When should anemia clue us that it may be from a plasma cell disorder?
For anemia, unexplained normochromic normocytic anemia without any other reasons to explain it, one of many, many things could be myeloma. But oftentimes, in those situations, hematologists are called on to do a bone marrow because someone is telling them there's no Coombs test that's positive. There's no B12 folate iron deficiency. There is no renal failure to explain this. So it could be like an MDS or a bone marrow process that's going on.
And then there's a whole bucket of things that do not fit into the CRAB mnemonic, things like cardiomyopathy and neuropathy.
The next things that we look for are people who look like they have a restrictive cardiomyopathy, or they complain of a big tongue, or there's anything to worry for amyloid. Monoclonal gammopathies can cause peripheral neuropathy in multiple ways. One is an unexplained distal ascending patients who can have a significant axonal neuropathy from amyloidosis. Another is a patient who has a demyelinating neuropathy from the POEM syndrome with the osteosclerotic lesions. So again, not every neuropathy, but neuropathies which have those kind of features, numbness, fingers, toes, without any explanation. So suspected myeloma, suspected amyloid, suspected Waldenstrom's. We had a patient, coming in with hyperviscosity, usually presents with bruising and gum bleeding and epistaxis without any reason. And, you know, the patient's IgM is like 7,000 or 8,000 milligrams per deciliter. So you worry about, you should think of it in unexplained hyperviscosity and so on. I think you think of all the ways in which plasma cell disorders can cause a real problem. And in those situations, you will get the test.
Okay. So what I'm taking away is that in addition to the classic CRAB, high calcium, bone lesions, significant proteinuria, casts on a kidney biopsy, unexplained anemia, in addition to these CRAB features, it is nice to be reminded that monoclonal gammopathies can present in other ways, like with amyloidosis or polyneuropathy, or in the setting of IgM gammopathy, hyperviscosity, especially if someone's having nosebleeds that are unexplained or gum bleeding.
And then lastly, just to summarize, what is a monoclonal gammopathy? It's really a clone of one type of plasma cell that is producing one type of antibody. And depending on how many clones of the plasma cells and that particular antibody, this can present in a spectrum of ways, anywhere from MGUS to multiple myeloma.
Okay, so now that we know what a monoclonal gammopathy is, and we have an idea of the types of patients we should be sending testing on, I cannot wait to clarify what the difference between these tests are. I think a lot of us just write SPEP, UPEP in our notes, and I don't think we have a good understanding of what each of these tests are telling us and how to prioritize them.
Yeah, so these tests can be really confusing, but I think we can break it down into simple terms. So let's start with the serum test, and then we'll do the urine test in pearl number 3.
So let's go over the testing for monoclonal gammopathies. So there are 3 main tests, and we have to dig back a little bit to our biochemistry. So SPEP, serum protein electrophoresis, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's an electrophoresis. Immunoglobulins are proteins, okay? So they'll carry a charge. And when you put blood on the electrophoresis, on the gel, it will be separated. It will separate out the proteins based off the charge, and you'll see clear distinctive peaks. There's different regions, and one region is called the gamma region, not immunoglobulin G, but the gamma region on an SPEP. And that's where all the immunoglobulins will fall, or the majority of them. So IgG, A, D, E, M. Okay. And you should see a smooth distribution because you're making different proteins. But if you have a small clone or a large clone of plasma cells, you'll make more of one antibody than the others. And that will be a spike in the electrophoresis pattern. So we call that an M spike, which means you have an M protein, which means you have a clone of plasma cells. So the SPEP will identify that, but the SPEP does not, this is where I think people get confused. So the SPEP quantifies the M spike. It will give you the quantity in grams per deciliter usually. Okay, so like 0.5, 3, 5. It will not qualify. And what do I mean by qualify? SPEP won't tell you the flavor. And when I say flavor, is it IgG, A, D, E, or M? You need another test for that. The SPEP is also not super sensitive. You can have bona fide amyloidosis and dying of it in a normal SPEP. So I will repeat this numerous times during this talk. If you are worried about a monoclonal gammopathy, you have to unfortunately order all the tests. But if you're going to do it, you need to order all the testing, which is an SPEP immunofixation and serum free light chain. So that is the SPEP. It quantifies the M spike, but it's not super sensitive and it can miss it.
Okay. So to recap, the first serum test is the SPEP, which is really an electrophoresis gel that separates proteins. And if you put a drop of your patient's blood on the gel, and those proteins all have the same size and charge because they're clonal, they'll all end up at the same place on the SPEP and create a spike, which is called an M spike or a monoclonal spike.
Yes. So that SPEP allows us to quantify the protein, aka the antibody that the plasma cell is producing. But the SPEP does not allow us to qualify the protein, right? We don't know if it's an IgG, IgA, IgM. We don't know the type.
Exactly. And that is where the immunofixation comes in.
The immunofixation is just like the protein electrophoresis, supercharged, where we run several lanes. And in each lane, you add an antibody against IgG, IgM, IgA, kappa, lambda. And so if you see a monoclonal protein, looking at the immunofix, you can tell based on which bands are reacting. Is it IgG kappa? Is it IgG lambda? And so on. So the SPEP tells you, is there a monoclonal protein? If so, how much? The immunofixation tells you, is there a monoclonal protein? If so, what type?
Love that. So SPEP equals, is there a monoclonal protein? And if so, how much? Immunofixation equals, is there a monoclonal protein? And if so, what type? To put it into other words with a coffee shop analogy, the SPEP is the receipt that tells you how many coffees you ordered. The immunofixation is the label on that coffee that tells you if it's a vanilla latte or a caramel macchiato.
Thank you, ChatGPT, for that wonderful analogy to hammer it home. All right. So, Nate, we talked about three different tests, and so far we learned that the SPEP might not be as sensitive. We learned that the immunofixation shows us the type of monoclonal antibody or protein. What is the third test that's going to help us understand what's going on in that bone marrow a little better?
Okay, so the third and last serum test is the serum free light chain assay.
Ah, and I love going to the basics here, Nate. So what even is a free light chain?
So a serum free light chain measures the amount and ratios of both free kappa and free lambda light chains. And let's hear from Dr. Rajkumar really about what this means.
The serum free light chain assay is a brilliant assay because what it does is it only measures the light chains that are circulating free, unbound to the immunoglobulin, because the immunoglobulin itself has two kappa and lambda light chains. So the assay is quite good in the sense it looks for epitopes that are hidden unless the light chain is actually free and circulating in the circulation. Now, I usually tell people, you know, our body is just so well regulated that this immunoglobulin molecule, so we are really good about making only the light amount of light chains we need. We don't make extra. But all of us do have normal serum kappa level and a normal serum free lambda level. And normally there is a ratio.
The ratio varies from about like 0.65 to like 1.5 to 2, but they should largely be equal based off just pure probability. If you have a clone, each clone will only be kappa or lambda. It can never be both. But one clone should only have kappa or lambda. So you will see a skew in the ratio, either towards kappa or towards lambda. And that is a hint that there's a monoclonal gammopathy. That is the most sensitive test.
Oh, I really appreciate learning like why that ratio is close to one. You know, if we think about it, it's just by chance that if our body's producing all these different plasma cells, we're going to see a rough number of equal plasma cells that are producing kappa light chains and a rough number of equal plasma cells that are producing lambda light chains.
An important caveat to that rule of thumb that the ratio of kappa and lambda is relatively equal to one is that when the GFR starts to dip, we might see some skewing in that ratio.
Keep in mind when interpreting this, as your renal function declines, and unfortunately, a lot of patients with decreased renal function are worked up for gammopathies because gammopathies can cause renal failure due to numerous mechanisms, due to a very complex thing. Your kappas go up. You just can't get rid of them as fast. So as your renal function declines, your GFR, there will be more kappa and you will start seeing a skew towards kappa. If you go to UpToDate, I always have to look it up. It tells you where it should be for a various GFR because I get these consults all the time. Just know that when interpreting the kappa to lambda.
All right. So I guess before I consult him for an abnormal serum free light chain test with more kappa per se, I should peek over onto that GFR and see, hey, is this result in line with what you'd expect with decreased clearance of kappa compared to lambda free light chain in chronic kidney disease? I love that. That really just gets me curious then. Are there any other ways that the serum testing for monoclonal gammopathies can be thrown off and we should take it with a little bit of a grain of salt?
Any kind of infection, inflammation, it's just a polyclonal process. Anyone with infection, inflammation, autoimmune disease, you see polyclonal elevations of IgG and A, right? Just like that, the kappa and lambda free light chains can also go up. And depending on the day of the week, the ratio might be slightly out of range. And you don't want to immediately think the patient has a monoclonal disorder.
So interesting. So then what types of infection or inflammation really create that polyclonal elevation of IgG or IgA?
Yeah, that's a great question, Shreya. So it's really going to be the more chronic infections and inflammation that cause that polyclonal rise in immunoglobulins, things like TB or hepatitis B. And we really should see a roughly equal elevation in kappa and lambda free light chains.
Yeah, so it's not going to be the run-of-the-mill UTIs or pneumonias that confound our interpretation of the serum tests?
Yeah, acute typical hospital infections shouldn't really affect it. So go ahead and send that testing in those cases. And patients with myeloma often present with infections, and we don't want to delay the diagnosis just because we're worried about how to interpret the test.
Yeah, I guess this is a good reminder. It all comes back to our level of suspicion that there's a monoclonal process going on, and we just have to interpret it in the clinical context if this is acute versus chronic inflammation.
Exactly. And then one other thing I got to appreciate was just one of the reasons why the serum free light chain tests are the most sensitive.
Yeah, why is that? What's so great about serum free light chain tests?
So there are plasma cell disorders that are making only light chains. And we have to remember that a normal immunoglobulin makes two heavy chains and two light chains. And typically, it's too big to get filtered through the kidney. But if that plasma cell is dysfunctional, such as in multiple myeloma, it might produce light chains that are easily filtered in the kidneys and therefore don't build up in the blood.
If a plasma cell was making only light chains and it was aberrant enough, it's not making heavy chains anymore, those light chains can get filtered in the kidney, and so you will miss it. Therefore, the free light chain assay helps you pick up those people who have just light chain only problems.
So that's why we say that SPEP is not as sensitive. The light chains can easily be peed out, so the serum electrophoresis won't be able to pick it up. So the SPEP will not pick up those patients with light chain only disease. And that's about 15% of patients.
Yeah, man. I guess I forgot about that, like heavy chain versus light chain. And it sounds like at the end of the day, at least we can count our two buddies, Kappa and Lambda light chains, to tell us if something's off.
Okay. To ensure we have a clear understanding of free light chains, let's practice with one clinical scenario. So imagine you have a patient in her 80s, and she was admitted to the hospital with heart failure and chronic kidney disease, and she has a creatinine of 1.9.
And I'm guessing because of the topic of our podcast today, somewhere along the way, someone sent off an SPEP, an immunofixation, and a free light chain.
You guessed right. And thankfully, there's no detectable monoclonal protein on SPEP or immunofixation.
Nice.
However, the free kappa and free lambda are both elevated. Kappa is 106 and lambda is 46. And that ratio is also abnormal at 2.18. So let's hear from Dr. Rajkumar how he'll tackle this case.
Excellent question. So your patient has a high kappa, high lambda, but the ratio is almost close to normal, like 2.18, which is close to 1.65. And so up to 4, I think, is just normal. So in your patient's case, I'll just say patient's got an elevation of serum free kappa and lambda with a very borderline abnormal ratio that's consistent with just renal failure. It's within the renal reference range. And so reassure them that there is no clonal plasma cell disorder. I'm even more confident because you have other metrics. Your IgGA and M are normal. There's no serum monoclonal protein. I'm more confident that's what's going on. It's very easy to reassure them.
Ooh, there is a hidden gem in that. So the ratio of kappa and lambda up to 4 can be considered normal, even though the technical range for normal is 0.65 to 1.65.
Nice. That's great. And why don't we recap here? And honestly, Nate, I do like to do the recaps, but our expert discussants said it so beautifully. So I'm going to give them the mic to cement things for us.
They really did.
But now I hope you understand the testing. All three of those testing should be done. And to reiterate myself, the SPEP is the least sensitive, but we'll quantify it. Quantification is very important because that's how we delineate between MGUS and smoldering myeloma. That is also how we stratify risk for those various disorders. Immunofixation is more sensitive than the SPEP and it will qualify it. That's very important because if I have an IgG or an versus an IgM, I'm thinking about different things. You know, when I have an IgM, I'm thinking Waldenstrom's and all these other things versus an IgG. And then the light chain is the most sensitive of the tests. Many amyloidoses or even myeloma can be light chain only that will be completely missed on the SPEP and immunofixation that only the light chain assay will pick up. So all three of those should be ordered.
And there are certain conditions that can kind of confound the picture a bit. Renal dysfunction can skew the kappa-lambda ratios that it won't be, you know, close to one. And then chronic infections or inflammation can cause a polyclonal rise in immunoglobulins, but not the monoclonal badness that we're looking for.
And I also like the way Dr. Rajkumar summarized the three tests. And he also added numbers to the sensitivity.
Keep in mind, if you suspect multiple myeloma, and you did all these three tests, the SPEP will be positive only 80% of the time because 20% of the time, either the patient has only light chains or the M spike is too small to be seen on the SPEP. the immunofixation will increase your sensitivity to 93%. You will still miss the people who have only light chain type of myeloma that's coming out in the urine. So if you do all three tests, you'll pick up 98% of multiple myelomas. So that's why when you're looking for something, you know you're looking for something, order the three tests. And based on the result, you can say with confidence whether somebody is likely to have myeloma or not. Of course, like every test, there'll be 1% or 2% who have multiple myeloma, but they're not really making any immunoglobulins because the cell is malignant, so it's not normal. And in those patients, you'll need biopsies of the bone and things like that.
All right. Now on to urine testing. You know, we went over the three serum tests, but we often do send off a UPEP. And where does that fall in our initial workup?
I don't actually usually rely on the urine testing that much anymore. We used to use them for response criteria in amyloid and myeloma. We've largely moved on from that and just looking at the capital lambda ratio.
Wow. Again, so interesting, right? Because we write SPEP, UPEP all the time in our notes, but it sounds like we will be just fine with a serum test of SPEP, immunofixation, and free light chain. And we don't necessarily need the nurse to chase down the patient for a urine sample.
Yeah. And I'm glad about that. It's always hard to get that urine sample. So in the past, without free light chains, the UPEP was helpful for the added sensitivity because few other proteins got filtered out in the urine. But now, because the free light chain assay is so sensitive, those added benefits of the UPEP are really no longer needed.
We are recommending to do the UPEP only if we know the patient has a clonal plasma cell disorder. And when you do a UPEP, it's the same as the SPEP. The urine doesn't have that many other proteins. And so the UPEP's actually quite easily, it'll pick up a gamma an M spike in the urine. Even much smaller ones than in the serum can be picked up in the urine because the background is so faint. And like, you know, you have a straight line and then an M spike. What the UPEP will tell you is because you're measuring a 24-hour sample, it'll give you the milligrams per deciliter of urine, the concentration of the M spike, as well as because you've measured the 24-hour, it'll tell you how many milligrams per day, which is dependent on the volume of urine.
Great. So let's summarize this quick pearl. Urine testing for initial workup is less important now, particularly because we have more sensitive tests like the free light chain assay. You really only need urine testing if you have somebody who already has a diagnosis of monoclonal gammopathy, or if you're working up a monoclonal gammopathy in someone because they have kidney disease. In those circumstances, you really do want to quantify the amount of protein in the urine. But most of the time, this doesn't need to be sent. Okay, now let's say we had a patient in clinic who had a monoclonal protein found in recent admission. The patient in clinic is now completely asymptomatic.
And of course, the patient Googled M spike and is worried they have multiple myeloma. So how do we clarify that what this abnormal finding means depending on the level of immunoglobulins? And more importantly, how do we help our patient understand the diagnosis?
Yeah, in other words, how do we differentiate the classic continuum of MGUS, smoldering myeloma, and multiple myeloma?
And how do I know if it's something to worry about or not?
This is where refreshing the spectrum of plasma cell disorders is helpful. Let's start with MGUS, and with each disorder, let's review what the next management step will be.
So, you know, you need to now know the tools to figure out where they are in this continuum of MGUS to smoldering to myeloma. So MGUS is asymptomatic monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. All of these, right, from clonal plasma cells to overt malignancy, we kind of arbitrarily draw these lines in the sand. This is a continuum, okay? So you have to use clinical judgment too with this. But MGUS means the SPEP, which we learned quantifies it, the total protein is less than 3 grams per deciliter. And the bone marrow biopsy has less than 10% plasma cells. If you have less than 10% plasma cells and an M spike less than 3 grams per deciliter, and you are asymptomatic, you have MGUS.
All of this, by the way, is very look-upable, but the numbers you will find when you look it up is 3 and 10%, right? Less than 3 grams per deciliter of M spike and less than 10% of plasma cells on bone marrow biopsy. But come to think of it, say we have a patient with 1 gram per deciliter of an M spike on the SPEP. Do I really need to consult heme for a biopsy?
Because most of these patients, we don't get a bone marrow biopsy. So in general, MGUS has a 1% risk per year of progressing to myeloma or another related plasma cell dyscrasia. However, some MGUSs are more prone to that than others. And so beautiful studies, largely from the Mayo Clinic, looked at risk factors for worse MGUS versus not so bad MGUS. And the risk factors include the quantity of the M spike. So if it's greater than 1.5 grams per deciliter, you get a point. It can't be greater than 3, because once you're greater than 3, you're no longer MGUS. So if it's greater than 1.5, if it's a non-IgG, so if it's IgM, A, D, E, that gets you a point. And then if the kappa to lambda ratio is skewed, and there's different cutoffs, but just remember if it's skewed, you know, more than 5 to 8 to 1. If you have none of those, you have, which is actually most of the MGUSs, that is extremely low risk MGUS. Their risk of progressing is not zero, but close to zero. They actually don't even need any follow-up with a hematologist, okay? And they definitely don't need a bone marrow biopsy. If they have any of the other points, we typically do recommend a bone marrow biopsy, although in some I do not, and that's a judgment call, but definitely they should be referred to hematology.
Okay, so in patients with an abnormal SPEP, we need to ask ourselves three questions to see if they need hematology and if they need that bone marrow biopsy. Number one, is the M spike on SPEP greater than 1.5 grams per deciliter? Number two, is the monoclonal protein on the immunofixation something other than IgG, such as IgM or IgA? And number three, is the free light chain ratio skewed in a ratio that's greater than 5 to 8? These things would be more suspicious for something like smoldering myeloma, and we really do need that bone marrow biopsy to make sure those plasma cells are not more than 10%.
And if they don't have these three red flags, then we can give our patients some assurance. And I'm sure what they're going to be really grateful to hear is that this MGUS that they have has less than a 1% chance per year of progressing and no invasive testing is needed.
Yeah, they really will be. And common things being common, let's say we have a small, less than 1.5 gram per deciliter IgG kappa MGUS, aka a low risk MGUS. Let's hear Dr. Rajkumar's take on these low risk patients and what monitoring looks like for them.
5% of the general population over the age of 50 has an MGUS. I don't want to do a bone marrow biopsy on 5% of the general population or a bone survey or get referrals, you know, every time somebody sees a monoclonal protein. The lifetime risk of progression to myeloma related disorder is only like 2%. So it's not even 1% per year. So it's like 0.1% per year. So there's no point in making them anxious and no point in putting them through stuff. So what we recommend is, you know, small IgG kappa MGUS. What do I do? What we say is just always recheck in 6 months to make sure you're not catching something just as it's taking off. And then if that's stable, then you can just check it only if symptoms occur in the future. You don't need a baseline bone marrow. You don't need a baseline bone survey.
I also appreciated hearing just how much this label can affect patients and how Dr. Rajkumar counsels patients with this diagnosis.
The second thing is, even after you diagnose the MGUS, you can reduce the psychological effects to patients by really reassuring them correctly. I look at their age and I look at the size of the M spike and I don't just use the 1% per year risk of progression. I fine-tune it to what I know based on the M-spike size, the type, and the free light chain ratio and their age, and then give them a real judgment call on what is their real risk of progression. And you can even frame it the opposite way. Just tell them you have a 10% risk in 10 years, which means 90% chance you won't get anything in 10 years. And then they are a lot more reassured. We launched a website just on our own called myelomarisk.com, where you can just plug in the M spike, the free light chain ratio, and the type of M spike, you know, whether it's G or A or M, and it'll tell you what is the risk of progression over the next 20 years or 10 years. So you can tell the patient for their size of M spike, what is the risk of progression likely to be, which will be some quite often lower than even the 1% per year. So you can reduce their worries to some degree.
Yeah, it's a great website, myelomarisk.com, which we'll link in our show notes. And again, just to say it out loud, I'm so glad we can reassure most patients with low-risk MGUS that, hey, you have more than a 90% chance of not getting anything in the next 10 years.
So we say if something is bothering you, like something's not right, definitely go for the workup, regardless of the M spike size. 1 gram, you'll still do it because you think, no, I think this patient could have myeloma because their calcium's high or something.
Yeah, I really appreciate that caveat that despite that less than 1.5 IgG M spike size, you know, in other words, that low risk MGUS, if something feels off, like the degree of calcium or the proteinuria, you really should still consult hematology to get their thoughts on a bone marrow biopsy.
Yeah, rules of thumbs are just rules of thumbs, and not everybody fits in the typical case. We all mentioned non-IgG MGUS and light chain only MGUS. How should we think about risk in those types of patients?
I have recently expanded this low risk group to also include small IgM MGUSs. This IgM hardly ever becomes myeloma. If at all it progresses, it'll be like a Waldenstrom's, which is an even more indolent disease. And then finally, the people who have light chain only MGUS, in the sense the serum SPEP and immunofixation are negative with no IgG A or M, but the light chain ratio is abnormal. So if in the free light chain ratio is less than 8, I say like omit the bone marrow, omit the bone survey, just recheck in 6 months. And if it's stable, leave them alone.
Nice. Yes. Okay. More patients that can be reassured. So it sounds like if they have small IgM MGUS, or if the free light chain ratio is less than 8, and in some places they even say less than 5, we can just follow patients every 6 months.
Yeah, it sounds like it. You know, after hearing from our expert discussants, I feel pretty confident managing these low-risk patients with MGUS myself.
Yeah, same. It's funny how prominent it becomes in our one-liners when, you know, it might not be that much of a to-do. Then why don't we just kick it up a notch, Nate, and move on to smoldering myeloma. What's the level of M spike or plasma cells on bone marrow biopsy that points us to a more of a smoldering diagnosis?
And let's say now you do a bone marrow biopsy and there's more than 10% plasma cells, but less than 60. You now carry a diagnosis of smoldering myeloma. The other way to get a diagnosis of smoldering is an M spike greater than 3 g/dL. So either or, if your M spike's more than 3 or your clonal plasma cells greater than 10%, you have smoldering myeloma. And in general, smoldering myeloma carries a 10% risk per year for the first 5 years of progressing the myeloma. For the subsequent 5 years, once you make it 5 years and don't progress, you're not so bad. It's more like 3-5% per year. And if you make it a decade without progressing, you're just an MGUS, and it's more like 1% per year. But if you do the math, about 50% of patients or more will progress within 5 years.
And just to say it out loud, when he means progress to multiple myeloma. So we can think of MGUS and smoldering myeloma as precancers. The caveat is MGUS and smoldering myeloma have very different risks in terms of progressing to overt cancer, which is multiple myeloma.
Yeah, and to reiterate, in that patient without end organ dysfunction that has an M spike greater than 3 or a bone marrow plasma cell burden greater than 10%, you have smoldering myeloma. And thankfully, if a patient makes it about 10 years without progressing to multiple myeloma, their chance of progressing becomes much lower. But we can leave this counseling and decision-making to the hematologist with their patients.
Yeah. And the other key thing here is that both MGUS and smoldering myeloma, there is no evidence of end organ dysfunction, right? There's no CRAP, no high calcium, renal insufficiency, anemia, or bone lesions.
Yeah. And now let's talk about when there is end organ dysfunction. When you are worried about multiple myeloma.
Now, what's the definition of myeloma? So myeloma is cancer. All these other things we were talking about are really just polyps. They're not cancer, although they do have different risks of progressing to overt cancer. So myeloma, up until 2014, all you needed was an M spike, really of any quantity, but usually when they have myeloma, it's high, or they have a high capital lambda, and organ dysfunction related to the plasma cell clone. In the organ dysfunction, the mnemonic is CRAB, hypercalcemia, renal insufficiency, anemia, bone lytic lesions. But that CRAB needs to be due to the plasma cell. Classic example, I have seen patients with iron deficiency anemia and an M spike of 2 treated for myeloma. That is not myeloma. That is MGUS with iron deficiency anemia. You need to prove the anemia is from the plasma cell problem. You need to prove that the renal insufficiency is from the plasma cell. And that relies on judgment and doing enough of this. That's where it gets kind of hard sometimes.
I love how he kept it real and just said how hard it is to distinguish. And also a reminder that two different things can be true and not necessarily linked, right? We need to make sure that there is end organ damage from myeloma itself. Nate, you know, he did talk about the myeloma definition changing in 2014. What's up with that?
Yeah, I really thought it was important to hear the history behind the change from Dr. Rajkumar himself.
After 2014, the only major changes are if the bone marrow involvement is 60% or higher, it's automatically myeloma. So smoldering, instead of more than 10%, became 10 to 60%. 60 and higher becomes myeloma. We also added some myeloma defining events because we wanted patients to be started on therapy before they had end organ damage, not after. And unlike other cancers, myeloma was unique because the diagnosis of the malignancy was not dependent on the pathologist. Whereas with, say, breast cancer or colon cancer, the pathologist says adenocarcinoma of the colon, then it doesn't matter what size the tumor was, it's a cancer, and that's how you're going to treat it. Whereas in myeloma, they just tell you clonal plasma cell disorder consistent with MGUS, myeloma, blah, blah, blah. So we were in a catch-22. We didn't want patients to get crab features and only then be called myeloma. At the same time, we didn't want to treat people too early and then be treating people who have MGUS. So a compromise was made that patients who are kind of inevitably going to get crab features in the next year or two should really be called as myeloma, and we shouldn't be waiting on them. So that's why we have started the criteria we revised. 60% or higher is enough to call it as myeloma, regardless of whether the patient has crab features or not on the bone marrow. Now, same thing with the light chain ratio. The normal ratio, as we talked about, is within 0.26 to 1. 1.65. But if the ratio is more than 100, that's very high, markedly high. And in those levels, the kidney can be damaged. And so we call that as also myeloma, with some caveats that the urine should be positive. You know, you don't want the urine to be a false positive. So urine should show significant monoclonal protein in the UPEP. If the ratio is higher than 100, that's also myeloma. And then if you have focal lesions on the MRI, even before lytic lesions show up on the bone survey, that's also myeloma.
Okay. So it's helpful to understand the reasoning behind these changes. So since 2014, we now use the slim crab criteria to define multiple myeloma.
Slim crab? I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, it's a great mnemonic. So in addition to your crab features, which is your end organ damage due to the plasma cell, you can now be up-diagnosed, if you will, from smoldering to myeloma if your plasma cells are greater than 60%, S for 60. If your light chain ratio is greater than 100, LI for light chain, or if you have two or more focal lesions on MRI, M for MRI. And these don't have to be just lytic bone lesions. We now call this entity slim crab.
Yeah, I will definitely look out for that. Again, this criteria is very look-upable, but why don't we summarize this high-yield section? And again, instead of me taking the mic and doing it, Dr. Goodman did it so much better and summarized it so succinctly, so we'll let him take the mic.
So to summarize the continuum of MGUS to myeloma, MGUS is asymptomatic, an M spike less than 3 grams per deciliter, and bone marrow plasma cell less than 10%. And then you can further risk stratify them based off those things I talked about. Smoldering myeloma is in between, with a bone marrow burden greater than 10% and or plasma cell M spike greater than 3 grams per deciliter. And then myeloma is symptomatic with crab or a very high plasma cell burden of 60% or light chain ratio greater than 100 to 1.
Okay, so we talked about MGUS to smoldering myeloma to straight up multiple myeloma. There is this other thing out there called monoclonal gammopathy of clinical significance, aka MGCS. And, you know, we know MGUS as monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. So what's MGCS? Is it like symptomatic MGUS and it becomes significant?
Monoclonal gammopathies of clinical significance are not cancer. They are MGUSs, but unfortunately, that for whatever reason, the antibody that's produced by the clone of plasma cells has properties, paraneoplastic properties, that can cause all sorts of havoc on the patient, from kidney disease, heart disease, to hemolytic anemias.
Yeah, so with MGUS, the plasma cell clone is the worry. But in MGCS, the secreted immunoglobulin itself is causing the problems.
So the most classic example of a monoclonal gammopathy of clinical significance is AL amyloidosis. So amyloidosis is not a bona fide cancer, although it's very harmful to patients and actually more lethal than many cases of multiple myeloma. But they don't have cancer. They don't have problems from the neoplastic cells invading tissue. They just have a problem from the monoclonal protein depositing into tissue and causing organ dysfunction.
Yeah, and just to reinforce, Dr. Rajkumar had a really good way of how he separates MGUS versus MGCS in his mind.
So we are dealing in plasma cell disorders not only with the pre-malignancy, MGUS, or the malignancy, which will be like myeloma, plasmacytoma, Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, but a whole slew of disorders which are caused by the simple fact that either of these benign or malignant processes is secreting an immunoglobulin. And this immunoglobulin can cause problems because it targets various things. And if it's by coincidence targeting the peripheral nerve, you'll get a neuropathy. If it targets the glomeruli, you'll get a glomerulonephritis. If it just misfolds, it'll cause amyloid. If it precipitates in the cold, it'll cause cryoglobulinemia. If it agglutinates in the cold, it'll cause cold agglutinin disease. So there's a whole list of diseases it can cause simply by virtue of the fact that this is a functioning antibody. If it doesn't have any antigen in the body to react to, it's just an MGUS. But some people have the bad luck that this innocent antibody, which would have been innocent and part of a clone like a polyp, actually likes your kidney or your lung or your something. And then you have a second problem, which is just bad luck. So those things are collectively now people are giving them the name of monoclonal gammopathy of clinical significance.
Bad luck indeed. And I guess it's bad luck because we really can't predict which MGUS are going to have immunoglobulins that are causing problems and become clinically significant. And I think what sucks even more is that, like, say a patient doesn't have too much of an M spike, if those immunoglobulins like certain tissues too much, they can cause awful symptoms.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. So MGCS should be on the differential diagnosis really in any patient with what appears to be a monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, but yet they're experiencing these other unexplained symptoms.
Yeah, I mean, it's humbling to think that there's just tons of ways these immunoglobulins can kind of wreak havoc on our body. And I think to maybe make it feel a little bit less overwhelming and a bit more manageable, maybe we can learn about the three main buckets of the ways it can cause clinical significance.
When I think of my monoclonal gammopathies of clinical significance, I divide into three categories: skin, neurologic, and renal. So renal is the most common, and they're all nephrotic problems. And you actually don't need to know all these because you're going to get a biopsy, and the pathologist will tell you which one it is on the biopsy. But the most common is amyloid, and there's also something called light chain deposition disease. It's not amyloid, just the light chains directly deposit in the glomerulus. And then there's a gazillion other ones with weird names that I'm not going to go into, but just know that the kidney biopsy will sort that out.
So if we see nephrotic range proteinuria, it could be a monoclonal gammopathy that's become clinically significant for the kidneys with either amyloid or free light chains depositing.
Then there's the dermatologic ones that are some of my favorite. One is Schnitzler syndrome. Okay, so Schnitzler syndrome is, you get this urticarial rash. Now, there's lots of causes of urticaria, but it's really pretty bad. And they also have arthralgias and fevers. And it's like a rheumatologic symptom. And typically what happens is they think it's rheumatologic and they end up getting a skin biopsy. And you'll see this neutrophilic urticarial rash on DermPath. And that's unusual for the rest of them. And hopefully a dermatologist, someone heard of this. And then you check an SPEP and immunofixation, and it's always an IgM. So if you have an IgM and you have a neutrophilic urticarial rash and some of these other symptoms, that's Schnitzler syndrome.
Yeah. So the second bucket are the derm manifestations, and there's a ton. And ultimately, the biopsy might show actual deposition of antibodies, or the antibody could just be causing problems in a more paraneoplastic way.
And finally, the neurologic ones. So the most common is this IgM neuropathy, but it now has a formal name. It's called DADS-M, a distal acquired demyelinating syndrome with M protein, DADS-M, but it's IgM neuropathy. And these patients have a axonal demyelinating neuropathy that usually starts in the feet and ascends upwards. It could be in the hands. It can be quite debilitating, and they will have an IgM. The other neurologic syndromes, there's POEM syndrome, which is polyneuropathy, organomegaly, endocrinopathy, M protein, and skin changes. I would say for the internist is there's some pretty weird syndromes out there. When you have these patients with weird things and you can't explain it, know that MGCS exists and read the review that I just told you about. There's 3 to 4 pages. It has all these charts to funnel you in, and you can think if this could somehow match.
That article that Dr. Goodman was talking about is from ASH Education that we'll link in our show notes. It nicely summarizes these. And again, can I just say out loud, there's just so many ways these monoclonal gammopathies can become clinically significant.
There really is, and it can be overwhelming. But I think it's helpful to broadly bucket these into renal, skin, and neurologic presentations. And I think as an internist, the take-home point here is that you should understand that these exist. And if things are not adding up, you can consider testing for a monoclonal gammopathy, consulting your colleagues for assistance, or considering a biopsy of the affected tissue.
So yeah, Nate, what is the takeaway you really want people to take away from this, Pearl?
Yeah, so I think remember that there is a constellation of diseases bucketed into this MGCS category that are due to the monoclonal plasma cell secreting immunoglobulins that are really just wreaking havoc on our body. And these often affect our kidneys, our skin, or our nerves. And don't feel like you need to memorize these entities, but remember that they exist and that they should at the least be kept on your differential.
Especially if it's a patient with MGUS and has some unexplained symptoms.
Exactly.
You know, just like taking a step back, now that I know so much more about monoclonal gammopathies and the different ways they can present, you know, I worry that a lot of us will start ordering SPEP, unifixation, light chains too frequently and just end up diagnosing a lot of MGUS.
Yeah, I think that's a really valid concern. And it really brings us full circle to back to the beginning of our podcast when Dr. Rajkumar reminded us that 1 in 5 people in the general population above 50 have one of these monoclonal gammopathies. While it can be exciting to diagnose one of these entities, I think we need to be equally judicious about testing as well. And more importantly, I think we need to understand the burden that these diagnoses come with.
The goal is not to find MGUS. We do not want to identify MGUS. Like, we want less MGUS. MGUS means they're asymptomatic and they have this protein. So asymptomatic individuals should never have this testing done, ever. This is the truth of the matter if you look at the data. It is very hard to make healthy people better, but it is very easy to medicalize healthy people. And once you get them an SPEP, depending on who their hands lie into, they get a PET scan, a bone marrow biopsy, and a huge amount of testing and anxiety done. Then they're stuck seeing me the rest of their life. Use with caution. So that's why I argue if they're healthy, don't order these tests.
And so let's end with Dr. Goodman, who openly shared a personal story that I think so aptly highlights the hidden psychological effects of being diagnosed with MGUS, and really on the broader idea of being humble about our ability to fix problems in medicine.
I mean, I could tell a personal story. My dad doesn't care. He's got my dad, 68-year-old guy. He had mitral regurg that was repaired. He's doing great. And like, he likes to talk about me. He told his PCP I'm a hematologist. And like, my dad had an elevated total protein. He ordered an SPEP. My dad had an M spike. And at the time, I didn't know better because I was still in training. I was like, I set him up with someone of prominence. And a lot of testing was done. And, you know, he's got smoldering myeloma, but like in my opinion, now that I know this, he's an MGUSer. But that caused a lot of anxiety for my dad and a lot of testing. And the funniest part about it was on his repeat CMP, his total protein was normal. So what sparked the test completely resolved. And now he's medicalized and, he's dealing with this.
And that is a wrap for today's episode. If you found this episode helpful, please, please share it with your team, your colleagues, someone else who could also kind of have an aha moment from the podcast. Give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. And if you want to learn more, check out the Corium website and the Behind the Scenes YouTube channel with an awesome interview that Nate did with Dr. Vincent Rajkumar and also Dr. Aaron Goodman. He had the very hard job of going through these interviews and picking out the best teaching. And so the Behind the Scenes interviews will just...
Yeah, there are so many good sound bites. And many thanks to our reviewers for this podcast. And shout out to Jerome Reyes for audio editing. This episode was made as a part of the digital education track at BIDMC.
Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliate institutions. Thank you.